The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to Short Circuit, your weekly podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeal. I'm your host, John Ross, joined today by your regular panelist, Evan Burnick, as well as special guest, Robert Everett Johnson. If you enjoyed the podcast, be sure to leave a review on iTunes. As always, we welcome your feedback at shortcircuit@ij.org. This week on the show, do police have to obey no trespassing signs? Can the government offer pro-life specialty license plates, but not a pro-choice option? And a malicious prosecution. Evan, kick us off.
Yeah, this case comes to us out of the Tenth Circuit, and it really goes to show the lengths to which judges are prepared to go in order to ensure that the government wins Fourth Amendment cases. It gets going when the ATF receives a tip that a certain man, his name is Carlos, who's previously been convicted of a felony, is in possession of a gun, possibly a machine gun, and he may be selling methamphetamines. They go to the home that he is staying at. He doesn't own the home. He's staying there. And they knock on the door for several minutes. Nobody answers, and then eventually somebody comes out around the side of the house. The cops talk to this person. They eventually talk to Carlos, and they go inside the house. He allows them to come inside the house. While they're there, they see what appears to be drugs. The owner of the house eventually finds out that the police are there and tells them to leave, but by that time they've already seen the drugs, and later he is actually charged with a crime as a consequence of what they saw. Now, the issue that's raised in this case is whether they even had the authority to enter onto his property and knock on the door in the first place, given that there are no trespassing signs displayed prominently all over the place, on the driveway, on a post. And the question is whether, consistently with the Fourth Amendment, they could even approach the house.
And what does the panel judges say?
Well, so the opinion splits three ways. You have the majority who seems to say that essentially any no trespassing sign is never going to be enough to tell the police that you can't come up to the house and knock and ask to be let in. You have a concurrence that says, well, the no trespassing sign here doesn't seem to be specific enough. And then you have a dissent from George Gorsuch who says, look, if you post a no trespassing sign, the police should assume that you mean what you're saying. If you say no trespassing, that means keep off my land. Don't come and knock.
Right. And the point that the dissent makes, and this is, I think, really the alarming feature of this opinion, is that both the majority and the concurrence rely upon arguments that the government not only did not make but specifically disclaimed. The government in this case actually argued that police have an effectively irrevocable right to walk onto your property, walk up to your door, and knock on your door. And there's really nothing that you can do to revoke their ability to do that one way or the other. So the majority and the concurrence are making arguments to justify the government's actions that the government actually did not make. And the dissent points out that not only should the fact that, three prominently displayed trespassing signs on the property should be enough to revoke any license that you might have to approach somebody's house, but the court shouldn't be in the business of making the government's arguments better or improving them or making entirely different arguments in order to justify their actions.
What claims did the government actually make?
So the government argues that, this is a very common law enforcement technique nowadays where police will do what's called a knock and talk. They'll walk up to somebody's door without a warrant. They'll knock on the door, and generally what they do is they will badger the person and suggest to the person that they really have no choice but to let them in and to search the house. One of the things about this case that's so amazing is we're supposed to believe that the defendant here just said, oh yeah, sure, come into my meth lab house, with no coercion from the police. That's what the police say. That's what the district court finds to be the case, but we learn in a footnote that the defendant actually has a completely different story of what happened, which the district court simply chose not to believe.
Right, and there's another element of this. There's been a lot of empirical work done on how people, private citizens, respond to police officers showing of authority and how they interact with them. The courts, the Supreme Court, has in a number of cases focused on the fact that whether an officer is uniformed or whether he has a gun visible implicates whether somebody is voluntarily consenting to deal with that officer, to the point where, unless, you know, the guy's uniformed, he's got a gun, it's visible, it's definite, they will basically say that if you're not interacting with in an adversarial manner with the officer, then you're consenting if he's searching your stuff or if he's coming into your home. But private citizens don't respond to police officers that way. The force does not need to be outright and in your face for people to know that if you don't agree to what a police officer is asking you to do, you could get into trouble, and they respond accordingly. So there's a real disconnect between our case law and the lived experience of ordinary Americans that deal with police.
And so what the government is arguing here in their briefs is that there's nothing that you can do to prevent the police from exercising this tactic of coming onto your property and knocking and then talking to you and demanding to be let into your house, that there is no sign that you could post that would be so clear that you could tell the government, keep off. Now, the court doesn't agree with that. The court says that there might be something that would be that specific. But what they say is that these no trespassing signs, which are, to be clear, posted all over the property and say in big letters, no trespassing, that that's not enough to tell the government to keep off your property.
The dissent actually suggests one sign that might be enough.
Yeah, I mean, the dissent mocks the notion that the homeowner didn't go to sufficient lengths to indicate that whatever implied license police might have to approach the house has been revoked. So it suggests an alternative sign to the no trespassing sign that reads, the implied license discussed by the Supreme Court in Breyard v. Alexandria and Florida v. Hardeen's is hereby revoked. So we are now going to have a cottage industry in signs that contain legalese such that private citizens can ensure that police officers don't walk onto their property without their permission. It's ridiculous. The dissent is right to mock it, and it's an unfortunate result in the case.
And you got to believe, too, if someone actually posted a sign like that on their property, the police would look at it and say, well, that's really suspicious. That's a person whose house I definitely want to search.
Right. And who's to know whether the police are actually going to be able to interpret this sign, which is written in such specific detail that they don't know what it means. So it's a ridiculous result, and the dissent is right to mock it.
Okay, let's move on to the next case. Rob.
All right, so this next case out of the Fourth Circuit is an interesting case study in what do you do as a court of appeals judge if you disagree with a Supreme Court decision. And this is a case that arises out of these state license plate, vanity plate programs, where you can get a plate that has a particular message on it. In this case, it's North Carolina. You can decide to get a North Carolina pro-life license plate. But if you're pro-life, if you're pro-choice, there is no pro-choice alternative to this pro-life license plate. So you can get a license plate that endorses one point of view but not another. And the question is that viewpoint discrimination, where the state is essentially censoring pro-choice viewpoints and favoring pro-life viewpoints? And the Fourth Circuit had said that this was censorship, that these license plates effectively amount to private speech, and the government is allowing people to have one message but not another message. But then the Supreme Court, in a case called Walker, very recently said the opposite. And Walker was a case out of Texas. The Supreme Court says that license plate programs are actually government speech. And because it's government speech, the government can say whatever it wants. The government is free to promote certain ideas and not others. Now, Walker seems like a pretty much a ridiculous decision. I mean, when you put a license plate on your car that says has a pro-life message, for instance, it's a pretty clear endorsement of that message. It's not the government saying that it's pro-life. It is you saying that you're pro-life. But that's what the Supreme Court says. They disagree with that. And so the case comes back to the Fourth Circuit. And the question is, what do you do if you're a judge who disagrees with this the Supreme Court's decision?
Right. So the majority in this case disposes of it very quickly. The license plate program is basically identical to the one that was upheld by the Supreme Court in the Texas case in Walker. They held that this was consistent with the First Amendment. Therefore, North Carolina's virtually identical scheme is consistent with the First Amendment. The dissent spends a great deal of time really focusing on the dangers of the approach that the Supreme Court took in Walker. It purports to distinguish Walker from this case and North Carolina's license plate program from the one in Texas, but they're really not different. And the dissent's primary concern is with the idea that the government can simply by regulating more and more speech, effectively adopt private speech as its own and thereby evade the restrictions of the First Amendment. So the government offers this program. It invites people to, submit logos, designs, statements to put on license plates. And then all of a sudden it says, no, we don't like this message, we don't like this message, we don't like this message. If that is considered government speech, the government can do what it wants with it. It can say no for whatever reason. But if it's private speech, the government can't be in the business of picking and choosing sides. The problem, of course, is if the government opens up this program to all comers and then suddenly starts picking and choosing, it should run into the First Amendment, but the Supreme Court has effectively held that it doesn't.
Yeah, and the dissent really does something sort of interesting here where they actually quote statements from the North Carolina government where it's advertising this license plate program. And the North Carolina's advertisements are saying, you should buy these advertisements, you should buy these license plates because they'll allow you to express your feelings about things, which is clearly the state saying, like, this is a way for you to express your own opinions, which makes it private speech and not governmental speech. And which means that the government can't censor it by having one viewpoint but not another. Basically, the dissent is saying that the state here has been hoist by its own petard, right? But all of that is really irrelevant because I'm sure you could have said the same thing about the Texas program that the court addressed in Walker.
Right. I mean, the Texas program that was involved in Walker, they signed off on license plates that said, I'd rather be golfing, go Buckeyes. The idea that the state of Texas is actually endorsing all of those messages is ridiculous. Similarly, with the North Carolina program, the idea that the government is endorsing the message, I'll rather be shagging, that was one of the license plates that's approved, is totally ridiculous. Nonetheless, there is this precedent, and what you see the dissent doing is basically engaging in spirited disagreement with the logic behind a recent Supreme Court opinion without quite saying, I outright reject it. But the Supreme Court has, in dealing with government speech, really opened up a door for government to regulate more and more activity and regulate more and more speech activity. The fact of the matter is that when the government speaks, it consumes resources, it diverts resources that would be used for other private purposes. And the more that it does that, the more the government speaks, the less room that we have to speak. So when it starts picking and choosing and adopting private speech as its own, it can get very problematic.
Okay, let's move on to the next case. Evan.
So this case involves an altercation between an inmate on Rikers Island who's scheduled to be released in less than 3 weeks and first one officer and then several officers. The altercation begins when he is ordered to move to a new bed. He refuses. He asks to speak to the officer's supervisor. What happens after that is disputed, but it gets ugly. He gets into an altercation with that officer. Then other officers show up. They allegedly handcuff him, beat him. I believe that they tase him. No, they pepper spray him. And he claims that they purposely drop him on his face. There are a lot of injuries. He's injured. A couple of officers are injured. And eventually, he is actually charged with felony assaults. And he's detained in 3 years before being acquitted at trial. He then turns around and sues the correctional officers for, among other things, excessive force, intentional infliction of emotional distress, and malicious prosecution, claiming that they falsified their incident reports in order to essentially frame him. And the question is whether his claims can go forward or whether there's simply not enough evidence and they can be dismissed at summary judgment.
And what did the Second Circuit say, Rob?
Well, so just to add to that, I mean, this case actually goes all the way to a jury on some of his claims. He has these intentional infliction of emotional distress claims growing out of this beating.
And he wins
the
on
jury,
his claims.
And the jury rules for him and actually awards him over $60,000 in damages. So this is a guy who, there is a difference of sort of a, different accounts of what happened here. And yet there are two separate juries, the criminal jury and the civil jury, both of which have agreed with this inmate about his version of events. But the district court seemed to be limiting this guy's claims at every turn to seeking to limit the kinds of things that he could argue to this jury, which seems to be why he only got $60,000. And what the court says is the limitations that were placed on what he could argue, what theories he could present, and what evidence he could present were totally invalid, and he's entitled to a new trial to seek even more damages. from another jury.
And what limitations were those, Evan?
Well, there were a couple of them. First of all, they said that because there was enough evidence that was untainted, the prosecution untainted by the allegedly falsified incident reports that indicated that he was guilty of felony assault or attested to the fact that he had assaulted the officers, the prosecution couldn't be malicious. And second of all, they actually prevented him from introducing evidence concerning the incident reports because they said that it was inadmissible hearsay. And the
and this is really remarkable, actually, the reasoning of this. The trial court said that because the police officers had already testified on their own behalf that the reports that they submitted that he's claiming were falsified reports were simply cumulative of the testimony that the officers had already given.
Right, which makes no sense because the whole claim is that they used these incidents reports to prompt a malicious prosecution. He's not suggesting that, and this is where the ridiculous hearsay thing comes in. The problem with hearsay evidence is that it's unreliable, and therefore we don't want to admit it to prove the truth of anything. But he wants to admit this evidence into the record and show it to the jury, not because it's true, but because it's false, and it shows that the officers falsified these reports. And further, the claim that there was independent, untainted evidence, the supposedly independent, untainted evidence that the prosecution had access to was in the reports. So everything is effectively as tainted as those incident reports that are critical to his malicious prosecution case are. And the idea that this should have been excluded, it's ridiculous.
What exactly is malicious prosecution?
It is what it sounds like. It's deliberately manufacturing a case against somebody that you know not to be meritorious out of spite.
Yeah, and it's interesting here. I mean, prosecutors are so insulated from any kind of liability for the decision to charge somebody. So in this case, the theory of malicious prosecution is not that the prosecutor did something wrong, but that these officers convinced the prosecutor to do to bring the charges through presenting false evidence to the prosecutor. If the prosecutor had done something wrong, he would be immune. Right. But the only reason this case is able to go forward is because the charge is that the officers who are involved in the beating misled and led the prosecutor astray.
Right. And it's good that this goes forward because they seem to be very plausible claims. The jury at least found for him on a number of them. And the district courts wrongfully disregarded some of this evidence. So
where does the Second Circuit land?
The question was initially resolved on a motion for summary judgment. We've now decided that it shouldn't have been resolved on a motion for summary judgment. We're going to do discovery. We're going to gather more evidence, and we're going to go forward with those claims, with the malicious prosecution claims.
This is a great example of judicial engagement from the Second Circuit.
Okay, that concludes the show. Thanks for listening. Until next time, this is John Ross from the Institute for Justice, insisting that you get engaged.